This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This is the Ion Travel Podcast with CBS News travel editor Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here with another edition of the Ion Travel Podcast. This week from Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, where the World Travel and Tourism Council, effectively the G20 of travel, convened for their annual global summit. The reason? To discuss the cutting-edge issues of travel. Joining me, James Thornton, the CEO of Intrepid Travel, on over-tourism as well as responsible tourism. Two big topics. Then, another global travel issue that needs more attention. Travel with disabilities. John Sage, the CEO of Sage Inclusion, on the accessibility challenges within the travel industry, and some quick and simple solutions that need to be done. They're non-negotiable. And then, a conversation with John Wigger, the author of a fascinating book that deals with a wild and weird chapter of U.S. history, the hijacking of American Airlines Flight 119, how D.B. Cooper inspired a skyjacking craze, and the FBI's battle to stop it. First up, James Thornton.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all
in. Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
As some of you know, many years ago, actually not that many years ago, about 6 years ago, we were here filming our one-hour special as part of our continuing global television specials called The Royal Tour with the President Paul Kagame. And as part of that show, he took me up to the 9,000-foot level of their national park. We went trekking to see the incredible mountain gorillas. It was amazing. And of course, I had to come back and do it again. I did it this week. But there's another reason why I did it, because Rwanda tends to be a role model, at least in this area, of responsible tourism. They've done a lot of other things here in Rwanda. You know, you can't get off the airplane carrying any plastic bags. They'll take them from you. They've banned them. This is one of the cleanest countries you'll ever see. Every week, all the residents in every place in Rwanda come out and clean their streets. You don't see any litter anywhere. It's a remarkable country. But remember, over-tourism has always been on the agenda. Before the pandemic, I was worried about it not being on the agenda after, but it's back because a lot of people didn't learn their lessons. This country apparently has. You've got a population that of mountain gorillas that was shrinking, that they wanted to protect and preserve. And at the same time, interest in visiting them has never been higher. And joining me now, the Chief Executive Officer of Intrepid Travel, James Thornton. When I was up on the mountain yesterday, you were on the mountain right before me. But it wasn't like tour buses at the Acropolis. It wasn't like, you know, everybody waiting to get into the Colosseum in Rome. This is managed very, very well in terms of protecting these animals.
Yeah, isn't it one of those beautiful, iconic experiences, Peter? You saw it yesterday getting face-to-face with a mountain gorilla. But going to an iconic travel experience and not being completely overwhelmed by the crowds that you see before you. And you turn up in the car park, it's very well organized, it's very clean. The groups are separated. You head off with your local expert guide and leader and porters, and you have a most wonderful real-life experience coming face-to-face with the iconic mountain gorilla.
And no crowds.
And no crowds.
You see, it's interesting. This past summer, I'm sure you're aware of this, you had, on average, 30,000 people a day walking up the Acropolis in 100-degree-plus weather every single day. And how did the Greek government say they were going to handle it? Oh, we're now going to just limit it to 20,000 people a day. Even that is ridiculous.
Yeah, hot, expensive.
Right. And people were passing out. It's like, that's not an experience I particularly want to have. I don't think one that you want to have or your clients. So here's a country that basically came in from day one saying, okay, we don't care how many people want to come. We're going to tell you how many people can be allowed to come. Mm. And it's going to be a manageable number that really protects the natural resources, the gorillas, right, in their natural habitat. So they're issuing very, very few permits. You can only go in a group of like eight. You're only given basically an hour to have that experience. And by the way, if you're lucky enough to have it, an hour is pretty intense because as you experienced yesterday, I mean, these animals are up close and personal with you.
Yeah. And I think what's amazing, Peter, is when you turn up, the leader and guides who take you up in a small group of eight, the first thing they say to you is almost thank you for coming and thank you for contributing to your role in conservation in this beautiful country and protecting the mountain gorilla population. That was installed really early, right at the start, wasn't it, when we started the walk. You are playing an iconic role in preserving the conservation of the mountain gorilla. And as a result, we got told that the average lifespan of a gorilla is typically 35 to 45, but they've now got a female who's up to 48. And part of that is the role that tourism has played in conservation in the region.
You know, if you go back 25 years, this place was completely crowded with poachers. The actual natural habitat was being reduced. They were running out of their own resources. And what the government did was to basically say, okay, let's change the entire business model of tourism here in the country so that you get to follow the money, so that the money that people pay, by the way, it's not an inexpensive proposition. Let's be real about this. Everybody's paying between, what, $1,500 and up to get to have that experience. So if it's on your bucket list, you better save up, right?
And I think that's the key point, though, isn't it, Peter? It's, if it's on your bucket list, save up for this great opportunity, because it is the way the Rwandan government have fixed the solution. It's $1,500 for that 1 hour experience. So you can't just, not anyone can just turn up and rock up and do it. So you've got to make that saving. It is that financial contribution. But doesn't that make travel a more beautiful thing when you've really worked hard to go and then have that unique experience?
But it's also where the money goes, and that's the key. First of all, half the Rangers right now, people don't realize, are former poachers. They had to be re-educated to be able to understand that the animals were worth more alive than dead. That's number one. Number two, it's a government rule. I don't know what the percentage is. I think it's maybe 10%. That every dollar that you spend, right, 10% of that goes back to the local communities in the form, it creates jobs. It creates lifestyle. It elevates people. And all of a sudden, everybody is now invested. As one of the trackers said to me yesterday, this is going to sound strange, he said, but the poachers are now our partners in preserving this area. And they're actually increasing the size of the national park. Whoever heard of that?
It feels like tourism done right, doesn't it? And we can't say that too often with the many wonderful travel experiences that are out there, but Rwanda really does feel like it's got it right as a destination. Like you say, this misconception of what a country might be, it's clean, it's comfortable, it's secure, the airport's lovely. The way in which that guerrilla experience, the most iconic element of the country, is being managed is sensational, and it really feels like other destinations need to take the learning from Rwanda.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a devil's advocate question, though, and that is, everything sounds well and good, but the double-edged sword here is, aren't you then making this particular experience only for the people who have money? You may travel elitist.
The one thing I'd say, Peter, is to even fly to a destination like Rwanda, it's going to cost a couple of thousand dollars. So, yeah, it's another wise investment in terms of the $1,500 to come and do the gorillas. There are alternatives. You know, you can go and have the experience in Uganda where it is a cheaper price point. But I feel that travel is there to be savored. And I think saving up, flying to a destination costs a certain amount of money. The time spent in a destination costs a certain amount of money. And I think the gorilla experience, yes, it is expensive, but saved for. And it really then goes away as one of those most iconic lifetime experiences. So there are alternatives if you want to do it in a cheaper format in another destination.
And of course, for those people, and there are so many of them I know as travelers who want to come back with bragging rights, this is one of those bucket item list things you get to hold over all your friends.
Well, you and I get to travel a lot, don't we, Peter? And I still say it is one of the most iconic experiences I've ever done. Did it first time 13 years ago, and being face to face with the silverback yesterday when it was beating its chest.
Literally beating its chest. Still got hairs
standing on the back of my neck from the experience.
And how close were you?
Oh, virtually touching distance.
Yeah.
I mean, you literally are touching distance. It's amazing.
It truly is. But let's shift gears for a second, because Rwanda is a good role model of responsible destination management. We can see that. Where are the other challenges for you operating as you do all around the world?
Yeah, look, at the moment, obviously, there's always geopolitical challenges. There's alignment between private sector and governments, which often don't quite align. There's that demand of over-tourism, which we thought would not crop up in a post-pandemic environment, but seemingly
but it
we
did
saw,
even worse.
Well, we saw in Europe this summer, didn't we? I was in Rome myself, and you know, being at the Colosseum, being at the Trevi Fountain, just the crowds, the heat, the expense. It wasn't a great experience.
I like to say, in Venice, the Bridge of Sighs is the Bridge of Thighs.
Yeah, absolutely, you know? Absolutely.
And you know, we can make jokes about it, but you know, when you see the city officials in Venice wanting to put in a tax for people just they want to come into St. Mark's Square, or you see everybody say, I don't want to be another Barcelona, I don't want to be another Venice. I mean, are there practical solutions without disenfranchising people from trying to have that experience?
There does seem like a misalignment between the local experience and the consumer experience into a destination. I think Amsterdam's a destination that's starting to get it right. The way I always say, what gets incentivized gets done. And the way the Amsterdam Tourism Board is now leading its kind of key goal, it's about community engagement and consumer engagement in a destination rather than volume of visitors. And I think we've got to get away from this growth at all costs.
You know, I'm going to give you the travel industry metric, which I think is flawed. I think you'd agree. We here at the WTTC at this meeting, we're going to be meeting with a lot of ministers of tourism who seem to believe that their key to success is a numbers game, right? Average length of stay, average length of spend, blah, blah. But it shouldn't be that way.
No.
Because it destroys the quality of travel.
Yeah, it's got to be about the engagement of both the consumer experience who are paying for the going to a destination, but critically about the local community experience as well. And we can see places where it's gone wrong at times.
What destinations that you work with other than Rwanda are getting it right?
I think a destination like Costa Rica has always been a leader, Peter, in terms of sustainable travel practices, about the engagement with local communities, the way in which the government has gone about building more of an eco-tourism destination, the bonds that are now available in region and in market. Other countries that stand out for me, I think Morocco is a destination that's done it pretty well as well.
I'm surprised to hear that.
Yeah, no, I do. I think Morocco's found that striking right balance in terms of advertising the destination, getting more people into, of course, the iconic sites of Marrakesh, but also then the development outside of Morocco in terms of Essaouira or to the Sahara or some of the other less known places like Fez and Meknes. So I think there are some hero destinations that we can stand up. I think Scandinavia is doing it, areas in Scandinavia are doing it well, but I think at the moment, you know, anyone who travelled in the summer to Southern Europe would question some of the destinations in that region.
And continue to question.
Yeah, continue to question. It's expensive, it's hot.
I was on a ship this summer, was stopping in Mykonos and Santorini. I refused to get off the ship because it was obvious to me that I couldn't walk when I got there.
And I think if you're planning your travels now for next summer, for me, it's about off-season travel as much as possible. I think we're going to see May and June and September and October becoming more popular.
Because one of the solutions that Greece came up with a couple of years ago is, oh, we'll just extend our season into October and November. But people don't think in those terms. They really don't. Although we're seeing this and you're seeing this now, seasonality is starting to evaporate. It's no longer where are you going next summer, it's where are you going next week.
But I think people that had those experiences last summer, like me, I was going to Sicily last week of July, fires surrounding Palermo and Catania airports. It's high 40s during the day, low 30s
at night.
That's high
40s centigrade.
Yeah, apologies for my Australianisms there. And it's just, you know, I will be booking my travel this year in June and September. Now, I do understand school holidays limit that for some people.
Ah, but you know what? I have the secret for that. Do what my parents did with me. Make a deal with your teachers to get an extra credit assignment and take a week off during the school year.
Well, travel's the best form of education, Peter.
Well, we know that. But the thing is this. What's the week after Thanksgiving? It's the dead week. Nobody's traveling. And you know what? They're just recovering from their dysfunctional family get-together. That's when you go. The week after New Year's, they're just recovering. That's when you travel. You know, do an off-season approach. First of all, you're not going to France for a suntan. I mean, think about why you're really traveling somewhere, right? And then figure out, when nobody else is going to go, that's when you want to go.
Yeah. It's the secret of travel.
Even Alaska in the winter or Palm Springs in the summer, I'll find a way to make it work. Which reminds me, the double-edged sword, of course, where you're dealing with GDP numbers in certain destinations that are totally reliant on travel and tourism, and they don't feel they have a choice. So, for example, Hawaii, right? Take a look at their GDP numbers for travel. It's through the roof. That's it, right? Then you have that terrible fire in Maui, and people know, well, should we go now? Can we go now? If we go, will we have a negative impact on the environment? What's the way to responsibly do that? Because it doesn't take long to connect the dots that if you show up, somebody gets a job. If you show up, somebody gets to eat. They get to put food on the table. It's no different than going down the Nile in Egypt. If you don't show up, nobody eats. So where do you find that happy medium?
Well, Morocco is the best example of that for me, with the natural disaster of the earthquake that took place in September. And, you know, media coverage goes on that Morocco's had a massive earthquake and therefore people stay away from the whole country.
But you know what?
It was Marrakesh, yeah. And it was the Atlas Mountains. And the Atlas Mountains was the devastation. I was in Marrakesh 2 weeks ago. The city is operating perfectly normally. And the restaurants are increasingly getting fuller, the airplanes are getting fuller, and the hotels are getting fuller. So it's about education. When a destination gets hit by a natural disaster, clearly they're a place you have to avoid. The Atlas Mountains being that case, but Casablanca, Fez, Meknes, the Sahara, Essaouira, open for business, and they rely on tourism to get back traveling. So it's about taking that view of getting beyond the kind of key headline story and getting into the detail of where you can and can't travel.
We tend to be geographically ignorant and paint with a broad brush at the same time. I mean, you had Western Maui being devastated by that fire, but the other islands weren't affected, and the rest of Maui wasn't affected. And people, I can't go to Hawaii. But actually, you can. You just have to do it responsibly. Pick up the phone, call the hotel where you want to stay and say, can you accept me? And what can I do to help when I get there? You don't want to displace, I mean, they're putting people up who are their own employees who lost their homes, right? So you don't want to displace them. But if they get to a certain point where they can take you, why wouldn't you go?
Yeah, and we're seeing the same, Peter, with the terrible Middle Eastern conflict that's going on. Egypt, Jordan, destinations which our governments are telling us that we can get to safe and secure and rely on those tourism dollars. It's about people still getting out and having those travel experiences because we have seen higher cancellations to those destinations at this stage.
Let's go back to COVID days, right? The business shuts down. Cruises all stop. Airlines are canceling. People just have nowhere to go. Tour operators can't get insurance. So they basically stop. But where's the money going, right? You had so many defaults. So many people got left holding the bag. You had a number of foreclosures. You had a number of bankruptcies and liquidations. I often felt that if we were doing this responsibly, right, that if I'm going to book a tour or even an airline ticket, that the money should go into escrow. And then the money only gets released to that operator, whether it's an airline, cruise line, hotel, tour operator, when I actually show up and the ship leaves or the airplane flies or the tour begins. You agree?
I'm in complete agreement, Peter. I mean, you know, we saw, unfortunately, travel companies default who'd been living off client cash during the course of the years leading up to the pandemic with unsustainable growth levels. And I think those travel companies that looked after their customers well, refunded the money as quickly as they could under very, very testing circumstances, and have now come back and are growing very strongly. It's requirement on them to only be spending client cash when the client cash is ready for the travel experience. And it's absolutely critical. And travelers need to do their research, need to be speaking to their travel agent partner, getting on websites, checking out the financial stability of brands, which sounds a funny thing to do when you're thinking about the wanderlust of your travel experience,
but
critical to do.
Yeah.
And companies like Intrepid that openly and transparently release their accounts every single year, you can go on our website, see exactly how we're trading and performing, and knowing with confidence that your money is safe and secure when your travel plans happen, or in the worst case scenario, if travel plans get unstuck, that you're able to get your money back accordingly.
And of course, there's another side of the story in terms of risk from the credit card companies. I was talking to somebody at American Express who basically said, you know, if we look at a company, we think they're not financed properly, we're going to do holdbacks. And what a holdback is, but the customer doesn't know it, right? The traveler doesn't know it. So I pay my deposit, my $2,000 deposit to American Express, to the company, charging it on American Express, which is how we do it, or Visa or MasterCard, whatever that is. But they have no confidence in the operator. They tell the operator, we're holding it back until you actually operate. Well, if they're not properly financed to begin with, the operator never gets to the departure date, they default.
Yeah.
It almost creates a default.
Yeah, again, Peter, I think it's about doing customers' research. I think there's many review sites that are out there that very quickly, with a tap of a few keys, will provide you the information about, is this a company one that has honoured its terms and conditions? Is it a company that pays back in the events of problems or challenges? I think it's incumbent on all of us to be doing our research and booking and travelling with companies that have good track records.
Of course, right now, specifically speaking of the Middle East, we're in a very grey area because if you look at most travel insurance policies, they don't cover you if there's an act of war. Well, Israel has declared war, so they're off the hook, right? The tour operators, in many cases, are saying, and we're not talking about tour operators in Israel, we're talking about tour operators in the region. They're saying, oh, our trip to the pyramids is still going. We haven't canceled, so we're not giving your money back. Now what do you do?
Yeah, and again, I think it's incumbent on travel companies. Of course, travel companies want to keep operating for the reasons we talked about earlier, the benefit also into the local communities of people in Egypt and the tour operators there and the hoteliers and the transfer suppliers wanting to make sure they've got that form of income. But in Intrepid's case, we provided flexibility around our terms and conditions, giving people the option if they don't want to travel, they can take 100% travel credit and travel with us either to a different destination or back to those destinations at a different point. So again, it's back to the customer research, traveling with companies and booking with travel companies that have those more friendly terms and conditions.
And of course, read the fine print on the insurance policies, which I cannot understand, you can't understand. So buy it through a travel agent, have them walk you through the hieroglyphics of that language so you know what you're covered for, but even better, what you're not covered for.
Yeah, I often get a bit sus, Peter, with those kind of automatic credit card insurance policies. There's a reason why you pay a bit of money for travel insurance. And personally, I think it can be some of the best investment you can make, but make sure you buy that right policy.
And I've said this before, I've said it dozens of times. If you're going to book an airline ticket online, don't buy the insurance because they will not let you finish the transaction unless you opt in or opt out. Opt out, you can always buy the insurance from a third party when you understand what you're buying. Because, I have peace of mind, I want to be protected. And the language in that on that online page makes you think, if you don't buy their insurance right there, you're not going to be protected. Just the opposite. In many cases, you buy that insurance and you're not protected because nobody gets to page 5 of the website at that point because you just wanted to complete the transaction. So do yourself a favor. I'm not opposed to travel insurance. Don't get me wrong. But don't buy it at that moment online. You agree?
Buy it from a specialist, Peter. You buy your airline from a specialist airline, your tour operations from your specialist tour operator, buy your insurance from a specialist insurance provider.
My thanks to James. Now, it might surprise you to learn that 19% of the American public has a disability. It could be sight or hearing impairment or a mobility issue. No matter what the disability, the travel industry may still not be moving fast enough to literally accommodate the disabled traveler. John Sage from Sage Inclusion has lived that story.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first 3 orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
John Sage, the CEO of Sage Inclusion. How are you, sir?
I'm great.
And thanks, good to see you again, by the way.
Yeah.
You heard my long-winded introduction, but the point remains that cruise ships, there's another one for you. We have the Americans with Disabilities Act. Right? Going back, 40 years, more or less? And yet the provisions for enforcement aren't very good. And you'll see a cruise ship, for example, that may have ramped the interior of the ship. But if somebody wants to go ashore, the ports haven't done it. You pull into some ports where you have literally stairs to heaven. And how can you do that? I've said to cruise ship companies for years, why don't you, in an ecumenical way, just hold a press conference and say, effective immediately, we will no longer sail to the following ports until they make them accessible to all of our passengers. How fast would they have stonemasons out there ramping those places, right, John?
Correct.
So tell me exactly how you're approaching this problem.
Yeah, you're exactly right. There are accessibility challenges all throughout the travel industry, and as a result, there's this huge population that is either staying at home or not traveling as frequently as they would like to, and so there's a huge amount of money that's on the sidelines for the travel industry. I ask the question, why is that? I think a lot of the expertise in the travel industry in terms of accessibility is lacking. That's one of the things that we're helping. We're helping travel businesses and destinations with training and to understand this demographic better so that they can do a better job serving them.
I've always said, and please feel free to laugh, that the people who design hotels have never slept in one, and the people who build airports have never flown. So how do you get in there at the design level to say to them, like, when you're about to redo an airport or build a new hotel, this is what you need? There's a hotel in L.A., out by LAX. It's actually quite an old hotel now. It was the Holiday Inn Crown Plaza. That they were, the owners said, you know what, we're going to do something different. We're going to bring in the accessible community and ask them for their input before we actually finish the blueprints, right? Before you even pour concrete. What is it you need in the hotel, right? And you know what? It was probably the most accessible hotel ever, and nobody else followed the lead. I mean, they had the door eyepieces at wheelchair height. They had the right lighting. They had the right audio alarms for people who had sight impairment, or the right lighting for the people who had hearing impairment. And it's not difficult to do.
No, it's not. And it's not expensive to do it on the front end. There's a misconception that the Americans with Disabilities Act makes things accessible. And it really only covers the built environment. It does not cover furniture. And so a lot of the accessibility challenges that I encounter and disabled travelers encounter when you go into a hotel room is the furniture. So that could be the bed height. It could be the space under the bed to use something called a Hoyer lift that gets people from wheelchairs onto the bed. There could be chairs on obstructing the way to the lamp or to the curtains. The towels could be out of reach. There's all these things that can happen.
And we haven't even dealt with the bathroom yet because the sink height, how do you get the wheelchair under the sink?
Yeah, so sink height is one of the things. There's another quite too common issue is that in the roll-in showers, there's a chair or a bench attached to the wall, and often the water controls are out of reach from that bench.
You know, here's the other statistic that drives me a little nuts. And if 19% of the American public has a disability, then why are only 6% of hotel rooms handicapped accessible? Same thing with cruise ship cabins. You know, now I have to tell you something, and you're probably gonna hate me for this, but when I book a hotel room, I ask for one of those rooms if it's available. You know why? It's bigger. They actually give you more space. You know, and let's face it, this is the thing that drives me crazy about hotel design. Who says that a bathroom is a better bathroom in a hotel when it's got marble on the floor that you're gonna slip and kill yourself, right? So the reason why I want to book one of those rooms, they've got handrails everywhere. I can actually not kill myself, and I'm not confined to a wheelchair. So there's this disconnect here between design and effect, right?
Right. And it, you know, it's 19% that have a disability, but it's anyone that they travel with. Also, a recent business trip that I took, we couldn't find the accessibility information that we needed for a hotel, so we booked it. It took 3 hours for us to find an accessible hotel in Las Vegas.
Which has more hotel rooms than any other city in America.
In Las Vegas, and all three of the rooms went to the hotel that provided us the accessibility information.
Okay, you said 3 hours just to find one?
We wanted photos of the accessible bathroom. That was the big accessibility.
Okay, area. Now you've touched on another pet peeve of mine. If you go online to make a reservation, every hotel photo that they show you is garbage. It's shot with the widest angle lens, right? It makes you think you're staying in a palatial suite, and when you get there, the room is so small you have to go outside to change your mind. That's an old vaudeville joke, but the thing is, why wouldn't they make that information accessible? Because people will make choices that are important choices based on that.
Right. It's photos and it's measurements. So on the hotel websites, it should not just say, hey, there's a wide bathroom door. It should say the measurement of the bathroom door and the bed height.
Because nobody knows the width of your wheelchair more than you.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And which brings me up to airlines now. How many wheelchairs do airlines destroy every year? It's a growing number. Because the way that the planes are designed, I mean, with all due respect, sometimes I can't get down the aisle. And I'm an able-bodied person, right? How do you get a wheelchair down the aisle? You don't, right? Even in first class, it's not wide enough. So it's either a wheelchair manufacturing issue, or it's an airline design issue, or it's both.
Yeah, and there is progress being made in design of the restraints so that someone can stay in their wheelchair on a plane, but that is years away, but it is in progress.
And you want it to be your wheelchair, not an airline wheelchair.
Correct.
That you're not familiar with, because you could get hurt on that.
Correct. Yeah, this wheelchair that I use is designed for me specifically, and even more so for people that might not have use of their upper extremities. They can develop pressure sores if they're put in another wheelchair.
All right, so here's my question. Here you are in Rwanda, okay? You had to fly here. From where?
From Austin.
Okay. So did your wheelchair fly with you in the cabin, or did you have a stow it?
It went below. On some of the planes, they offered to put it on board. My wheelchair is what's called a rigid chair. It has to come apart. They offered. I haven't had a problem with it being lost or damaged. One of my big pet peeves is when the disabled assistance that brings me from my wheelchair to my seat using something very small called an aisle chair, when it doesn't show up on time, I'm the last one to get on board instead of the first one, and every eye on the plane is on me, and it's just not a comfortable feeling.
Well, now I'm going to tell you one of the reasons why you might be last getting on board. Are you ready? It's the scam use of wheelchairs by passengers. Under the rules right now, okay? Now, we're this is radio, but I'm sitting here, but I can stand up. You're sitting here, you're not going to stand up. If I'm going to go to the airport and I want to board first, if I want to check in first, if I want to go through security first, if I want to board first, all I have to do is ask for wheelchair assistance. And now somebody's dedicated to get me from the car to the counter. So there I am, right? Now I go right through security, right? I go right on the plane. And you know what the flight attendants call these flights? Miracle flights. Because when the plane lands, I can walk. When the plane lands, I can run. You know what one of the gate agents told me? I'm sorry, everybody, but I'm going to tell you. Every time they see this happen, they say, well, there goes Jetway Jesus. I mean, but it's a scam. And I understand. I mean, and the thing that you, the reason why you know it's a scam is because the fact that you got a wheelchair to board the flight means they've already alerted your arriving airport, and they have wheelchairs waiting. And these people are still waiting as people are going running by them. There's got to be a better way to do this so that people who actually need the help get it.
Yeah, it is a concern, and unfortunately what happens is the people that need it, they don't get it. And the travel businesses, they start to say, okay, well, we don't want to accommodate it. It happened with amusement park passes at Disney. It got abused, and it really hurt the disabled community.
And what's the solution? Bring a doctor's note? I mean, what?
It's difficult. I think it needs to be looked at it a holistic approach of why are these people, is the travel experience so bad that they have to fake a disability?
My thanks to John. A few decades ago, these were the stories that I covered in depth, and I also met many of the perpetrators. Author John Wigger tells their stories in a fascinating new book, The Hijacking of American Flight 119, How D.B. Cooper Inspired a Skyjacking Craze, and the FBI's Battle to Stop It. Talk about a piece of American history and the hijacking mentality. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Yes, wonderful to be with you.
You know, I go back to that day in November of 1971. I was a correspondent for Newsweek. And that started the wildest goose chase of all time, the hijacking of the Northwest Airlines flight in the Pacific Northwest by somebody whose manifested name was D.B. Cooper, who lowered the rear boarding stairs of a Boeing 727 somewhere over the Pacific Northwest, wearing a parachute, carrying $200,000 in small bills, and disappeared into the night, never to be seen again. That alone has inspired so many books, a few movies, and of course, a mythology that is still with us today, right?
No, that's correct. He became something of a pop cultural hero at the time and has continued to be so to this day.
And of course, while he has never been found, there's been some shredded, mildewed $20 bills found near the Columbia River, I believe. But other than that, it's still an open case.
I think that's really what fascinates people about Cooper. He wasn't the only parachute hijacker, not the only hijacker to jump out of a plane, but he was the only one who was never caught.
Well, let's talk about the other ones, because that's somewhat news to me, too. You know, I will tell you this story, John. Back in the late 70s, I went down to Havana, and I was on a mission to find all the hijackers. And guess what? I found them. In those days, Fidel Castro didn't return them. In those days, he kept them, and he found an old hotel off a side street in Havana, which got the nickname as the Hijack Hotel, because that's where he put all these guys. Now, can you imagine all of them sitting around in one room every morning having breakfast? What were they talking about, right? Well, so I went down there, and sure enough, I met with a couple of them, and the conversations were so pathetic. One guy, I'd say to one guy, well, so tell me about your hijacking. And he said, well, I wanted to go to Algeria. And the next guy looked at him and said, you're such an idiot. Why would you hijack a DC-9 to Algeria? You know it can't make Algeria. He said, well, I didn't know. I mean, we were dealing with some pretty lost souls down there. In later years, as you know, The Castro government made a decision that they would return all the hijackers immediately to stand trial back in the U.S. But tell me about the people who parachuted out.
Yes, so there were five hijackers who actually jumped after D.B. Cooper. They were all inspired in some way by Cooper. They were all grouped into about a six-month period from November 1971 to June of 1972. They were all caught, but, you know, in many ways, their hijackings were more daring, more complicated than Cooper's itself.
And that brings up American Airlines Flight 119, because that guy, what, commandeered a flight from St. Louis with a machine gun. He got, what, over $500,000 in ransom money, and he parachuted over Indiana. Wow. And he got caught.
He did eventually, but it took the FBI about a week to track him down.
Wild. Wild. But so I guess the question is, for that craze that started and everybody doing copycats, they all had different motives, didn't they? Some were political. Most were not.
No, especially the parachute hijackers were decidedly not political. They were what you might think of as ransom hijackings, extortion. At least ostensibly, it was for the money. Some of them were Vietnam veterans who came back from the war really at a loss for what to do with their lives. But it was not mostly political.
Wow. And then, of course, you had the truly crazy people, right? The guy with a pillowcase over his head.
Yeah, Rob Hetty, one of the parachute hijackers, hijacked a 727 in Reno, Nevada. Reno was known as hijacker's heaven because the security was so light. This was Rob Hetty. He had come back from Vietnam, really at a loss for what had happened to him and what to do with his life. And he ended up hijacking a plane in Reno, which was known as hijacker's heaven because the security was so light. He jumped over the 3-foot-high perimeter fence, ran across the apron with a pillowcase over his head with two eye holes cut out, and a 357 Magnum in one hand and a parachute in the other. He hadn't bothered to buy a ticket. He just ran to the aft stairs, you know, of a Boeing 727 and hijacked the plane.
By the way, you mentioned the Boeing 727. Here's a little known fact for trivia guys like me, otherwise known as av geeks. There's something, when the 727 was still flying, and most of them are no longer flying in commercial service in the world, they're certainly no longer flying in this country, but when they did, as a result of the DB Cooper hijacking, Boeing inserted on all the 727s called a DB Cooper switch. And the DB Cooper switch was placed on the tail of the plane, and it was activated actually by the wind. And when the plane was moving through the sky, the switch went into the downward position and then made it impossible for anybody to activate the aft stairs from the inside of the plane. So you could no longer lower the stairs in flight and literally walk down the plane and jump out. So if somebody was hijacking a 727, it was specifically because, I would guess, John, that they saw what DB Cooper did.
No, exactly. The 727 was the most widely commercially used jet at the time that had those aft stairs, at least aft stairs that were easily accessible. Some other planes had them, but they weren't as commonly used or as accessible.
And that's the DB Cooper switch. If you ever go to some third world countries where they're still flying the 727 in commercial passenger service, look at the back of the plane. You'll see a little bit of a flap on that side of the plane. That's the DB Cooper switch. Of all the hijackings, that you write about in this book, which one to you was the most ludicrous? Or let's turn the tables. Which one was the scariest?
Well, I don't know about scariest, but Martin McNally's hijacking of American 119 was certainly the craziest of the bunch, and went on the longest. It took the FBI about a week to finally track McNally down. He hijacked the plane in St. Louis on its way. Well, it had taken off from St. Louis on its way to Tulsa, asked for a little over $500,000. They went back to St. Louis, and while they were on the ground, a guy who had been watching the hijacking on television and listening to it on the radio was across the street at an airport bar and decided that in the middle of the night he was going to put an end to it. Got in his wife's Cadillac, rammed his way through the perimeter fence, and then as the plane was preparing to take off with McNally and the cash and the crew on board, he drove down the runway and rammed the nose gear of the plane at about 90 miles an hour.
Oh, my God.
Which then meant they had to switch to a separate plane, which is the one that McNally actually parachuted from. He jumped at 10,000 feet at 320 miles an hour. He had never parachuted before. The FBI only gave him a front reserve chute, a small front reserve chute. But he didn't know enough about parachuting to know that that was all he had. And he landed safely, landed without serious injury, but he lost the money on the way down.
Whoops.
He hadn't securely tied it to his waist. And when the parachute opened, the jerk of the parachute opening tore the money bag away with $500,000 in cash.
Okay, I got to ask the obvious question. Where'd the bag end up?
Well, it ended up in a farmer's field. So a few days later, a farmer thought he saw a groundhog in his soybeans and went out, and it was the bag of cash.
And did he turn it in?
He did, yes. Although a lot of his neighbors later told him he should have kept it.
Hey, John, would you have kept it?
Well, you know, he would have gotten caught, so probably wouldn't have been the best idea.
Well, wait a second. Was the money marked?
It wasn't marked, no. They had recorded the serial numbers, but yeah, I guess in that sense, no, it was not marked.
Aha. Uh-huh. See, John, another way of looking at it now. I don't know. You know, I that's always the age-old question. If you find a bag of money in the field, what do you do with it? And if it's got $502,000 in it, it gives you reason for thought.
Yeah, especially at the time that was, you know, today's money, well over $2 million.
Oof, that's right. So basically hijacking money invested properly over 20 years. I love it.
My thanks to John Wigger, to John Sage, and to James Thornton. And my thanks to you for listening to this Eye on Travel podcast. For more conversations with the world's leaders in travel, as well as answers to your travel questions, be sure to rate and review this podcast wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. And for all the breaking travel news, just log on to petergreenberg.com.
The Eye on Travel podcast is produced by Amanda Morris and Anthony Protis Chung. For more content from Peter Greenberg and the Eye on Travel team, visit petergreenberg.com. Eye on Travel is a production of CBS News Radio.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money, and maybe more importantly, on your life. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
It was the biggest scandal in pop music. The stars of Milli Vanilli, the Grammy-winning multi-platinum R&B phenomenon, were exposed as frauds, but none of this was their idea. So whose idea was it? Enter German music producer Frank Farian. He saw the success of acts like Michael Jackson and Prince, and he wanted in, no matter the cost. So he devised the perfect pop heist. Two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? They couldn't sing. But Frank knew just how to fix that. Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies and takes a never-before-heard look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when the truth came out, Rob and Fab were the only ones who got burned. Looking back now, it's hard not to wonder, why did everyone blame them and not the man pulling the strings? Follow Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.